Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Sequoia Nagamatsu wrote How High We Go in the Dark, a novel in which an ancient virus is released from thawing permafrost and it sparks a pandemic that kills millions, the COVID-19 pandemic had not yet begun. When the book came out, though, in January of 2022, it felt incredibly relevant to our moment in history in so many ways. It became a national bestseller, and it has been selected as the 2023 All Iowa Reads novel. Author Sequoia Nagamatsu is going to be at the Des Moines Book Festival on Saturday, March 25th. I will be interviewing him on stage at 10 a.m., The Des Moines Book Festival is an underwriter of IPR, and Sequoia Nagamatsu is with me now. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with the book, which begins in the year 2030. It begins with the threat of climate change. Climate change releases this virus that starts spreading first among children, and then later it mutates and affects adults. It's an incredible nightmare. And the book also takes place over really thousands of years as we look into the past and into the future. You have described this book as a book about grief. So tell me a little bit more about what that means.
The early seeds of the book really began with explorations of my own grief. I was living in Japan at the time, and my grandfather, who had helped raise me, had passed away, and I wasn't really able to say goodbye. And living in Japan, this culture where technology and innovation is butting up in very real ways against tradition and the world of temples and spirituality, I was really just fascinated with how other cultures, how futurists might envision maybe a better way of saying goodbye to our loved ones and honoring them. Because I think in my own grief, I realized that I think especially Western societies don't do a very good job of allowing time and space to actually understand what death means and to actually honor our families. It's not an uncommon response from HR to ask who died before you're actually given permission to go to a funeral.
Right.
Forget the fact that you might also be financially crippled by the loss of a loved one with the American healthcare system. So I was looking into Japanese specific cultural traditions and innovations. So funerary skyscrapers do exist in Tokyo. I was looking into, small nonprofit startups that were envisioning very innovative ways of dealing with the body, whether it's, implanting your body into a giant tree seed, or turning your ashes into a box of pencils, that could be a kind of strange memorial. I was just wanting to offer readers, and I think myself, alternative visions of thinking about those of us that we care about.
And so much of this book, which is not a linear narrative, I should say. It's in many ways, I would call it a braided novel. There are all of these different stories, but they are all connected in one big way and many small ways as well. But you explore a lot of the different ways that characters in the novel experience death, deal with death. You have some funerary practices that look very much like what we have now, and also some ideas of how they may morph in the future. You have selected just a short excerpt from the book that deals with how one family or one neighborhood deals with death. Can you set that up for us and read it for us?
Yeah, so this is from a chapter that's pretty far into the book. It takes place in the next century, And the plague at this point has been cured for generations. And a grandmother, the main character of this chapter, is attending the funeral of her grandmother, who was just a baby when the plague had been unleashed upon the world. So it's set in Japan, and I think this chapter does a good job of nodding at sort of the extended nuclear family of Japanese, of the Japanese culture, where it's not uncommon to live with your grandparents or even aunts and uncles, or just be very close to your family in that way. But because the plague had ravaged the world, and because climate change had basically flooded the city, turning it into an archipelago, neighbors just really united in a very tangible way, where they are sharing a very, very large urn and mixing all of their ashes together. So this is a scene from that funeral. The soulful ballads of Misora Hibari, Baba's favorite enka singer, woke me the next morning. I could hear crowds chattering outside, trucks beeping in reverse as they delivered tables and chairs and flowers. My parents had closed off half the street with orange cones they'd borrowed from the local elementary school gym teacher. From my window, I could see the Fujita sisters smoking on the outskirts of the commotion, scowling. Everyone except Uncle Michihiro wore a t-shirt and an ill-fitting sports coat, had donned a vibrant yukata, pinks and purples and oranges with ornate floral patterns. My mother barked orders to the delivery drivers while some of the uncles constructed pop-up tents. Mrs. Kishimoto and the priest, who had come all the way from Osaka, arranged flowers on the reception lunch tables. At the center of the affair, a large portrait of Baba, surrounded by white chrysanthemums, the traditional choice, and sunflowers, Baba's favorite. And besides this, lay Baba herself on a long metal tray beneath a plastic cover, as if her ashes were part of some buffet. Chopsticks rested on top for the family to use to pick out the remaining bones. The large urn, a nearly 3-meter-tall chrome egg, sat on a wooden cradle that my great-grandfather had carved, and etched all over the egg were the names of everyone in the neighborhood who had already contributed their remains. I imagined the ashes of my aunties and uncles, my grandfather, Gigi, all layered on top of the other, inside the pod, a stratum of our family. And I'll stop there.
That is Sekoya Nagamatsu reading from his novel, How High We Go in the Dark, from the chapter called The Grave Friends. And that chapter explores so many themes that you touch on in different ways throughout the stories that make up this novel. One of those themes are fraught relationships within families. That's something that comes back again and again. We see these kind of fractured relationships or strained relationships, the desire to reconnect. What made you want to explore that?
I think that's something that is, I think, true of the relationships in my life and my losses. But I think death, as sad as it can be, and as, you know, it can offer a time to reflect on the good things about a person, I think death and funerals can also provide an important opportunity to reflect on the problematic and often complicated nature of who is in our life. And how we might love somebody, but that love is often not unconditional. It often comes with conditions. And I think that's a very healthy and I think much needed exercise for people to walk through in their healing process, in their grieving process moving forward. And I think especially during a worldwide pandemic where there's this prolonged pause button where our life, you know, in our reality with COVID, where we've, you know, I think many people have not been living their pre-COVID life for quite some time. And that prolonged period of what you could call a kind of grief is offering an opportunity to hit the reset button. What do I actually value? Who do I really want to keep in touch with? who do I want to say I love you to more, and who do I want to cut out from my life? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we don't live forever, and what is going to be best for the best version of myself moving forward?
The plague that takes place in this book, I mentioned it already, but you wrote this book over many years before COVID-19 was thought of in any way. And well, it was finished before the pandemic, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I began, like, the very early seeds of it began in maybe 2009. And this is, you know, at that point, I didn't know I was writing a book called How High We Go in the Dark. I didn't know it was going to be a novel in stories or a braided novel. It wasn't really until maybe 2014, 2015 that I began thinking about this in maybe a more somewhat more expansive way. And that's around the time when the plague element had sort of entered the narrative. So it was a very kaleidoscopic journey. And writing this, non-linear, like the first chapter of the novel was actually a later chapter that I wrote in 2019. And there are certain smaller chapters that I wrote as I was doing final revisions of the book and realized that I needed to address gaps in time or moments during the plague's evolution in order for certain characters to connect, or in order for, you know, certain things that I brought up in other chapters to actually resonate a little bit more emotionally. But yeah, it was a very, very long journey. And I think I honestly don't know if I would have written this book in the same way had COVID-19 already come out. I think the fact that I was already doing my final revisions in 2020, I think contributed a lot to the book being in conversation with our moment in a very, I think, maybe optimistic way. I think it's a very hard book in a lot of ways, but I think if I had written this post-COVID, there probably would be less optimism than there is now. But I'm actually happy that kind of things happened the way that they did, because I think we do need books like this that do have that hope and optimism kind of running through difficult times.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Sequoia Nagamatsu, who is the author of How High We Go in the Dark. He'll be at the Des Moines Book Festival on Saturday, March 25th at 10 a.m. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Sequoia Nagamatsu. He is the author of How High We Go in the Dark. It's a novel that begins with the threat of climate change. Melting permafrost releases an ancient virus that starts spreading across the world, first killing children and then later adults. This book is a novel that takes place over thousands of years. We look into the past, we look into the future. Some people call it sci-fi, many people call it speculative fiction. And it's a book that touches on many themes that are incredibly relevant to life right now. Sequoia Nagamatsu will be at the Des Moines Book Festival on Saturday, March 25th. I will be interviewing him on stage at 10 a.m. The Des Moines Book Festival is an underwriter of IPR. And this novel is also the 2023 All Iowa Reads novel. So there will be many events taking place throughout the year. It's also a Talk of Iowa Book Club book for April. So we'll be talking more about the book in the future as well. And so before the break, we were talking about how you wrote this novel that includes a plague, and that's not really, it's a very, very important element in the novel, but mm-hmm. it's not really what you feel you were writing a novel about. It came into the process a little later on. But then we have a real plague that spreads around the world. What was your response? You're selling this book. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden this pandemic strikes. Obviously, you were dealing with all the other things that all of us were dealing with. But how did that make you feel about your book?
I mean, my agent approached me, you know, in spring 2020 and said that we're finally ready to kind of go on submission to, you know, reach out to editors with the book. And I think, you know, in the life of a writer, that's usually a very exciting moment. But I was also filled with, I think, a lot of anxiousness because I didn't know how receptive editors would be to a book that contained a plague, even if I thought it wasn't really a plague book with a capital P, that they would kind of just get the wrong idea. So I was very, very distraught, for the lack of a better word, for a little while, until I actually started getting responses from editors who seemed to really resonate with what I was doing. My agent and I were very careful with our talking points to make sure that we're controlling the narrative, as it were. So I wrote a personal letter to editors explaining the journey of writing this, that this was more like Station 11 and more humanistic, and that this wasn't, you know, a Hollywood sensationalized CDC racing against the clock to cure something kind of book. It really was more about small moments and family and connection and grief and hope. But even with that, it wasn't until I started getting responses from general readers, from advanced review copies, that I really took a breath and realized that, you know, the book could be part of a larger conversation. I think in early interviews, I was very hesitant and resistant to people calling it a pandemic book. But I think I've warmed up to the idea that it is a pandemic book because we are living in a pandemic and people are, no matter what, are going to draw parallels to COVID and what I've written. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if my book can be a source of conversation, a way of sort of thinking about what we've gone through, you know, in lockdown. And I've had family members, I've had parents, you know, email me, come up to me at festivals saying that my book had made me want them to hug their child or call their mom, or that it got them through a loss, whether it was COVID or they lost a family member, you know, from something else, that it was part of their healing process. So it's just been so heartening over the last year to see that evolution of the response and that this book could be a part of that.
Well, and I don't want to put words into the minds or mouths of the people who are on the All Iowa Reads Committee, but I suspect that that's a large part of why this book was picked as an All Iowa Reads book, because we've all been living in this pandemic environment for the last 3 years, and your novel gives us a unique way to explore that. But also, it is a lot about climate change, something we are also all living through in this time. There's also another Iowa connection, which is that you went to college in Iowa, in Grinnell, mm-hmm. or at Grinnell. So I have read that you really embraced activism, environmental activism, mm-hmm. as a student at Grinnell. So are there some seeds of this book that are planted in that way as well?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, I spent a lot of time, I would say, like, my primary identity when I was at Grinnell was like the activist guy that was shoving a clipboard in front of your face or skipping class to go to some place to chain myself up to something. So I was that student, you know, and, you know, for a time I thought, I imagined myself maybe even kind of making a career out of that, just kind of like living in the nonprofit world. But I don't think I let go of that completely. And I think, you know, even now, as a professor of creative writing, I'm also tangentially associated with the environmental studies department, and I teach classes in climate fiction, you know, and I teach in a program where I used to teach in a program called the Environmental Conversation. So it's something, you know, these issues are very near and dear to my heart. So I you know, I think in a lot of what I write, I do try to at least acknowledge that our world is changing very, very quickly, and I would like to imagine in my writing how we respond to that, you know, in good ways and bad ways.
We see this evolution throughout these stories. Again, it takes place over thousands of years. The different ways that humans are interacting with the environment and responding to this changing climate. You also have characters who are working their hardest to try to look for solutions, to try to really find a way to save humanity.
Yeah, this is something that I think when I teach a climate fiction class or an environmentally sort of oriented class, that my students get very, I think, despondent and dispirited because they care so much. They realize that their generation is probably going to be one of the generations that's going to have to deal with some of the, you know, severe consequences of previous generations. And they see all of these solutions being suggested in books that we read, but because of the nature of how the world works, our political system, our culture, the fact that we live in a capitalist society, there are severe obstacles to actually implementing any kind of a solution that would help the planet. And so I think with a book like mine, which I mentioned earlier, I think is very hopeful and optimistic. And I think part of the climate narrative there, an ideal climate narrative, is that we need to come together as communities. We need to heal our individual communities, and we need to embrace other communities and work together and have more empathy for our fellow human being than honestly we do in reality. And unless we're able to do that, we're not going to be able to move forward with these wonderful, you know, socioeconomic or technological solutions that could help us address climate change. So the book, I think, is, kind of looking through the world through rose-colored glasses. And there's actually very, very little, antagonistic forces that I let have center stage that would kind of draw away from that.
That felt real to me, though, not because we live in a place without antagonistic forces,
yeah.
because it felt like the pandemic in your novel had shifted. Mm. Maybe mm-hmm. I was just reading into it, but had shifted how people understood climate change and could see the very real mm-hmm. consequences of climate
right.
change.
Yeah, I mean, the plague in the novel is far more severe than what we've experienced. So I think out of necessity, culture had to shift in a more dramatic way. And I think, in some ways for the better.
I mentioned the term speculative fiction to describe this novel. I mean, there are definitely sci-fi elements in ways. I know you are a sci-fi fan. How do you think about genre? I feel like sci-fi is one of those genres that a lot of people, there's a lot of great literature that's part of sci-fi, but people kind of dismiss it as other in some ways.
I mean, I think people's understanding of genre, and I include scholars and critics in this as well, is often problematic and very binary. Where you're kind of talking about sci-fi as being this on one side and important, quote unquote, literary fiction, literature with capital L being on the other side. And that's simply just not how storytelling or literature functions. It's a spectrum, so you have books that are going to have elements of sci-fi and elements of beautiful literary writing. You're going to have books that are, fantasy mixed in with a thriller and it's sometimes the job of booksellers and marketing teams and sales teams to help, decide, what category this book falls under. Because, at the end of the day, categories are important for utilitarian purposes. But when I'm writing as a storyteller, I very rarely think that, oh, I'm writing, I'm only writing a sci-fi novel. Of course, I like to think about the traditions and the authors I'm drawing from, but I view storytelling as more of a spectrum. Now, if I'm pressed, if somebody asks me like how I would categorize my fiction, I am forced to kind of use the terms that people use on places like Goodreads or online forums. And, in practice, speculative fiction for a lot of people means literary fiction that's science fiction or fantastical in some way. You know, kind of beautiful science fiction, I guess. and I guess that's kind of an apt description for what I do. Like I come from a very kind of literary background. Like I have an MFA in creative writing. You know, I publish a lot, not exclusively though, in literary journals, but I also publish in sci-fi publications as well. And I think, you know, to kind of sum up, what people are talking about when they think about genre is really more about community. You know, Ted Chiang, who wrote the story that the movie Arrival was based on, is thought of as more of a sci-fi writer because he rose to prominence publishing in sci-fi magazines. Had he published more in the Paris Review, which I think he could have done, he probably would have be thought of more as, you know, maybe more along the lines of a Kazuo Ishiguro. Mm-hmm. And Kazuo Ishiguro, by the way, is a speculative writer, can be a sci-fi writer. But critics don't like to call him that because he won a Nobel Prize. So it's all very snobby.
Just read it. It's a good book,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
Well, mm-hmm. One of the things that I really enjoyed about the book and found myself thinking about is the majority of the characters in the book are of Asian descent. Either they are Japanese or Japanese American or, you know, some kind of heritage along those lines. And I found myself assuming that when I met a new character that they were Asian until you either indicated otherwise or didn't. And I was thinking about the fact that I think every other book that I have read where that has been the default in my mind have mm-hmm. been books that explore Asian identity. This is not a book that explores Asian right. identity. So tell me a little bit more. I mean, obviously you are Japanese American, mm-hmm. you're third generation mm-hmm. American, but how you thought about identity in the novel.
I think in some ways it does explore Asian identity and that it doesn't explore Asian identity, if that makes sense, because I think for so long, the only books that really got attention from not just Asians, but I think just any person of color and certainly more international writers were books that I think othered their communities or exotified them in some mm-hmm. way or pigeonholed the kinds of stories that those people could tell. Right. So it was always an immigrant story. It was always a rags to riches story. It was always a war story. And I have zero connection to those stories. You know, like my grandfather was in a Japanese internment camp, you know, during World War II, but that's not my story to tell. I nod at that, but I'm not going to write a complete book about that. And, you know, what I desired growing up was seeing more stories of just people like me. Just the diversity of the Asian diaspora, you know, the third generation, fourth generation Asian American who may or may not have strong ties to their heritage. And so in every chapter, we see, I think, you know, another Asian character, another Japanese American, but who might have a very, very different view on what that means for their life. And I think, you know, that's something that we're just starting to see more of in literature. We're starting to see more of it in Hollywood, I think, as well.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk just briefly about Star Trek, which I know that you are a Trekker. I myself mm-hmm. am also a Trekker. And I did come away with some of the most beautiful versions of grieving and remembering people in your novel reminded me very strongly of a Star Trek holodeck. Was mm-hmm. was that an influence for you? Do you think we should be grieving on holodecks?
I think it can be a tool, but I think a lot of the technological, any of the like sort of sci-fi things in the chapters, I think were there as aids when they were needed. But I think the takeaway for a lot of those character arcs is that, you know, the robot dog is a nice bridge for grief. It's a nice vehicle for catharsis, but eventually that robot dog is going to fail. You know, eventually you're going to have to exit the holodeck. And so it can be an aid in getting to the precipice of moving on. But you always have to kind of like wake up. You always have to put down the virtual reality helmet and actually live your life at some point.
When people read this book and they experience these relationships and these scenes of grief and the way that we interact with death and some of your ideas of how we might interact with death in the future, what do you want people to take away from that experience?
I mean, I think I want people to realize that grief, and I think grief can mean many things. It could be the active, moment of a feeling of sorrow for a loss, but I think it could also be something more prolonged, like what we all experienced in lockdown. It could be a grief for a life that we can no longer have back. And I think that I want people to realize that grief is almost never something that is just about destruction or the end of something. I think grief is also an opportunity for possibility, for hope, and for reimagining ourselves and the world around us. And I hope that readers kind of see that from How High We Go in the Dark, that, you know, through grief, through emptiness, through the silences, there's always light there that we can embrace should we choose to do that.
Sequoia Nagamatsu, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Sequoia Nagamatsu, the author of How High We Go in the Dark. It is the 2023 All Iowa Reads novel. It's a Talk of Iowa Book Club novel. We'll be talking about it in April. And Sequoia Nagamatsu is going to be at the Des Moines Book Festival on Saturday, March 25th. I'll be interviewing him on stage at 10 a.m. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. For Iowans who love literature, Des Moines is going to be a hotspot for the next couple of weeks. In a few minutes, we'll get a preview of Poetry Palooza, the new 3-day-long poetry festival in Des Moines from April 6th through the 8th. But first, Sequoia Nagamatsu is just one of the headlining authors at the Des Moines Book Festival on Saturday at Capitol Square. By the way, both the Des Moines Book Festival and Poetry Palooza are part of the Greater Des Moines Partnership, which is an underwriter of IPR. Amelia Klatt is the director of events for the Greater Des Moines Partnership, and she's here to tell us more about the book festival. Hello, Amelia.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And the book festival launched in 2019, which is a rough year to launch something because, of course, then in 2020, it had to be canceled. So tell me what's been going on with the book festival the last few years.
Absolutely. So 2019 is when the DSM Book Festival began. And like you mentioned, 2020 and 2021, we pivoted a little bit and we decided to do some virtual programming around the book festival. And last year, we were so excited to be able to have it back in Capitol Square, where it will be again this year.
So we just heard from Sequoia Nagamatsu, author of How High We Go in the Dark. I will be interviewing him on stage at the festival at 10 a.m. Tell me about the other headlining authors, because there are four of them.
Absolutely. We have four really great headlining authors this year. So Sequoia will be the first one on the stage at 10 a.m. Directly after Sequoia, at about noon, will be No Violet Bulawayo, who wrote Glory and We Need New Names, which were both highly recognized books by many different literature places. We also have Chris Bajolian, who wrote The Flight Attendant, which many have watched the show that features Kaylee Cuoco. And he recently wrote a new book called The Lioness, which is what he will be focusing on at the DSM Book Festival. And then to round out the fourth author, it will be Sarah Penner, who wrote The Lost Apothecary, which is in collaboration with the Des Moines Public Library's Avid series.
So that's a real variety of authors representing different genres, different kinds of work. How do you pick who you're going to invite?
Yeah, so we have a great committee that helps choose the different authors that we go for. Like you said, we really do try to get a wide variety. We try to cast the net far all across the nation and see who we can get. And we were just incredibly lucky to get these four authors this year.
Now, there are a lot of other things that go on at the book festival in addition to hearing from the headlining authors. Tell me more about all of the other events.
Sure, absolutely. We have a writer's workshop, which there will be a variety of panels in there for aspiring writers or people who have been writing for a long time, with a bunch of different genres in that aspect. We also have quite a few hands-on workshop and activities. There will be two different rooms with programming throughout the day. One that I'm very much looking forward to is how to make your charcuterie board better. So that will be incredibly interesting. We also
is that in support of people who want to have book clubs in their home? Is that the idea?
It is. That absolutely is. And later in the day, we will have a workshop on how to hold a book club or how do you start a book club. So it will you'll be able to know how to do a book club when you leave the book festival, that's for sure.
So the festival takes place from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. There's also, even if you're not attending one of the events, there's plenty to do and see in between, right?
Yep, absolutely. We have a main stage, which will have local musicians, as well as some spoken word. There is going to be a kids zone with a bunch of story times in there. Ongoing activities all day. There will be a magic show to end the day in the kids' room. We also have a wide variety of local authors that will be in the main atrium space throughout the day, over 30 of them, which is really incredible. There will be food. There will be anything you can think of. Even if you're not a book lover, I would recommend that you get down to Capitol Square on Saturday.
All right. And it's all day long, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. And this is a free event, although, of course, you're welcome to spend your money once you get there, right?
Absolutely. It is a free event. The only portion that is paid is we do have a VIP program for those that are interested in sitting up close for those headlining authors.
Well, Amelia, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely. Look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
Amelia Klatt is the director of events for the Greater Des Moines Partnership. She's one of the organizers of the Des Moines Book Festival. You can find out more online at dsmbookfest.com. Again, it's on Saturday at Capitol Square from 9 a.m. through 6 p.m. And Poetry Palooza is coming up as well. It's a new 3-day-long poetry festival taking place in Des Moines from April 6th through the 8th. And here to tell us all about it is one of the organizers, Jan Kaiser, who is also marketing and events coordinator for Beaverdale Books and a member of the Iowa-based nonprofit Poetry And. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Charity. Is this a great time for literature or what?
definitely is. And Jan, I keep saying this is a new festival, and it is a new festival, but it also has a long history. So fill us in on that a little bit.
Oh, I'd love to. Yes. In fact, many of the people on our committee were members of the Des Moines National Poetry Festival that started about back in the 90s. And they brought in this amazing array of wonderful poets. And that lasted about till 2005. And so some of the people involved decided, you know, after the pandemic, everybody needs a little more mindfulness, and I think there's a reemergence of people wanting to experience literature and poetry. So we got together. It's an energetic group of all women, not necessarily, but it just turned out to be. And we decided to create Poetry And, which is the umbrella organization. We do pop-up poetry events, and we did something in Perry during Art on the Prairie. We did Poetry and Pie in the Park. And now with Poetry Palooza, we are just going to pack the house with a powerful group of poets, and we're so excited. We also are really embracing poetry slams.
Poetry slams. And I hear you're relatively new to poetry slams. So this is a new passion of yours.
It is a new passion. I had never been to one until we did one in Perry, and now I am completely hooked. It is filled with emotion. And this poetry slam that we're going to be doing on the first night to kick off the Palooza, we have cream of the crop poets because the Iowa Poetry Association has put together three different slam competitions with four winners at each, and the poetry slam we will be offering will have those 12 winners plus Aquina G and Caleb Rainey. So if you've never been to a poetry slam, this is the one you got to go to, and it will be at Franklin Junior High on April 6th.
All right, and that's a Thursday evening, so you have to get your weekend of poetry started early. And there are going to be events kind of all over the place. So your website, poetryamp.org, because poetry and is an ampersand, so poetryamp.org will tell people all about it. You also have a whole lot of poet laureates, state poet laureates who are coming. Of course, we just have one here in Iowa, Deborah Marcourt, who is a fabulous poet and also a distinguished professor at Iowa State University. Tell me about inviting all of these state poet laureates.
Oh, exactly. And all the other events are going to be taking place at Mainframe Studios. And the reason we're having it on April 7th is that that's the first of the first Friday, and we have invited four poets laureate, either former or current. Also, beyond Deb Marquardt, who is a wonderful representative for our state, we have Karen Miriam Goldberg, who is a past poet laureate for Kansas. We have Christine Stewart Nunez, who is a past poet laureate for South Dakota. And we have Matt Mason, who is the current Nebraska state poet. There's a fun little story about Matt, too. Matt actually attended the Des Moines National Poetry Festival as a high schooler and met a poet. And now here it is, several years later, and he's a featured speaker. They will be performing in the big room during the First Friday at Mainframe, but the entire time of First Friday, we're going to be pairing all kinds of poets with all kinds of artists. There'll be open mic readings. There will be music. Deb Marquardt's bringing her band, The Bone People. There'll be hands-on activities. So another great chance to meet poets. And then we follow that up on Saturday morning with poetry workshops. And I've got a whole list of them, but some of the fun names are, I love what Matt Mason is going to do. It's called Let's Write a Ridiculous, Meaningful Poem. And then Karen Miriam Goldberg is doing poetry as a healing path. We have ekphrastic poetry, which I didn't even know what that was, but show up Saturday and you can find out. We also have a haiku workshop and just on and on. These are all on our website.
All right. And you're also going to be taking some time during the Poetry Festival to honor a poet that a lot of Iowans know and love, and he's well-known nationwide as well, James Autry. Tell me about honoring James Autry.
Well, James Autry was one of the original people behind the Des Moines National Poetry Festival and one of our favorites, and we just felt that now that with this new event, we need to honor Jim, who got it all started. He's a wonderful poet, very beloved, and he will be featured at the Poetry Slam. So a great combining of spoken word and page poetry, and just a wonderful tribute to one of Iowa's favorite poets.
Jan, looking at the list of poets that you have invited, I mean, it's clear that you have reached beyond the circle of the people who have been involved in this for so many decades. But I am curious, I mean, do you find that there is a younger generation who is excited about getting involved and picking up this mantle and moving forward?
Oh, absolutely. It has been so rewarding as we're working on this to tell young people about it. Of course, we have a whole student workshop during the day Friday. We're going to be having the Poets Laureate go in and speak to students. That's not open to the public, of course. But one of them is Kelsey Bigelow. She's on our committee, and she is a breath of fresh air. She is a true full-time Iowa poet. She's going to be leading the Poetry Slam. She's part of the Iowa Poetry Association, which is sponsoring it. And I do have to give one big shout-out to Humanities Iowa. Right from the get-go, when we first started talking about doing the Poetry Festival, they were on board. They said, yes, this is what we need. So we're just so pleased to be able to reach out into a diverse community. The spoken word will bring in the young people, and hopefully some of the not-so-young people are going to become new fans.
Now, I've talked a couple of times about a relatively new festival, spoken word poetry festival in Iowa City that takes place in the fall called the Mic Check Poetry Fest. Do you feel like there's a poetry movement happening in Iowa right now, Jan?
Oh, most definitely. Yes, as we're out and about and talking about this, the reception has just been nothing but enthusiasm. We don't know what to expect. We're hoping that we just pack the place with future poets and poetry lovers. And the thing is, poetry is really special. It's a great way to relieve stress. It's a great way to be mindful. It's been proven to be helpful when you're dealing with anxiety. So it just seems like the perfect time for Poetry Palooza.
Jan, I know that you love all kinds of literature and you're an incredible booster for all kinds of literature. What does poetry mean to you in your life?
Well, I tell you, it has helped me through some kind of dark times. And reading poetry and sharing poetry, meeting these poets and seeing how meaningful poetry is in their lives, it's just been very inspiring.
When you talk about poetry helping you through dark times, it does strike me, though, that with this festival, you are striking a balance between, I think, maybe a stereotype that a lot of people have about poetry being very serious and introspective all the time, and joy and fun with poetry as well.
Oh, absolutely. And anybody that sees our artwork knows that we are just celebrating poetry. And anybody that reads some of Jim Autry's poems, they are so humorous and so witty. And, yeah, they make you laugh. Of course, there's the other side, too. But pulling that emotion out, no matter what the emotion is, it just seems really healthy. And sharing emotion is what it's all about.
Well, Jan Kaiser, I hope that it's a huge hit. What are you hoping for with poetry and in the future?
Well, we just continue to put together new programs. In fact, we're doing one at Drake called Hearken to Verse. That's going to be in May. So please keep watching poetryamp.org. We've got all kinds of things planned. And April is Poetry Month, so celebrate with us.
Jan Kaiser, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
I've been talking with Jan Kaiser. She's one of the organizers of Poetry Palooza. It's a new 3-day-long poetry festival taking place in Des Moines from April 6th through the 8th. You can find out all about it by going to the website poetryamp.org. That's poetryamp.org. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News. Our producers are Caitlin Troutman, Danny Gear, and Samantha McIntosh. You never need to miss an episode of Talk of Iowa. Please subscribe to our podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, just search for Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.